The Cyber Show is pre-recorded from our studios in Pebble Beach, California. This show is sponsored by Management Analytics, trusted advisor since 1977.
Hi, I'm Fred.
And I'm Chris.
And this is The Cyber Show.
Would you like to have some cyber fun? Join the show and the fun will come.
This week on The Cyber Show, the pitch delivers on explosive growth, we hope. Bill discusses cyber education. John gets a nickname, and it's not a nice one, but he likes it. Doug peers into the future and is blinded by the light. More fraud, spies, and lies, and much more. Only on The Cyber Show. Here we go.
No politics, no religion, none of the seven dirty words. Don't believe what anyone on the show tells you. Check it out for yourself. The views expressed do not reflect those of the management or owners of the station, the websites involved, the sponsors, or anyone other than the individuals expressing them, and in many cases, not even them.
Everyone, we have an announcement to make.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m., join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
This segment's called The Pitch. In The Pitch, a company presents in the hopes that you, the listening audience, will find them interesting enough to go the next step.
Hi, everybody, and a very pleasant Wednesday to you, wherever you may be.
Sandy into his windup. Here's The Pitch.
Ken Miller from Stackable. Welcome.
Thank you.
So tell us about Stackable.
Oh, well, Stackable is a ceiling-based robotic storage and delivery system. It stores...
So when you say ceiling-based, I saw the video that you played. It's not a real video. You don't have a live system right now, right?
No, that's an animation. That's correct.
Yeah. I saw the animation, and what it does, this is fascinating. It moves around the ceiling to a different place in the ceiling, and then from there it drops down, I guess a rack or whatever is on the rack. It drops it down from above the ceiling so it's in the room, and now you can do whatever you want, and then when you're done, you just, I guess you push a button and it goes back up. And if you want something else, it'll go somewhere else in the ceiling. When I first looked at it, I was sort of scratching my head and saying, this is fascinating. And at first I didn't quite get it that you were pulling stuff down from the ceiling. I thought it was maybe a magic show.
Right. Well, it is kind of magic.
So the thing that came to mind is, well, wait a minute. Above the ceiling, there must be all this space where you're storing this stuff, right?
Correct. Yeah, there's cells above the ceiling. So depending on how much room you have, let's say up in an attic, in the middle, if you have a pitched roof, you have more space than you do on the sides. If it's a flat roof, you can just build the roof up a little bit higher than normal, and then you can get up to, you know, maybe even 4 feet of storage up there. And so what we have are these trays, and the trays can be anywhere from 1 inch to, you know, even 4 feet tall. That stack on top of each other up to a total of 4 feet. And they're latched up in the ceiling with spring-loaded latches. And the robot then moves around in this XY grid of cells and goes up and can unlatch the stack and lower it down.
It drops down from the ceiling using the otherwise unused space up above. And there are various problems with that, right? So that has to be conditioned space for this, because if it's, you know, in a real roof where it's real hot outside, not like where we live along the coast, 120 outside is probably, you know, almost 200 up under the roof. So things will melt. And then the other thing is somehow it has to be contained up there. Otherwise, it won't drop down. Something will slide off when there's an earthquake or something, and it'll not come down and get caught. So I assume you've figured out how to get all that stuff to work, right?
That's correct.
Is this retrofit so I can take an old existing home and just retrofit it?
It is designed to be retrofittable. It's designed to fit on the standard 16-inch center ceiling joists.
For most current ceilings, of course, if I have a really old house, it might be something else, but so it goes. Now, it's dark up there and, of course, not temperature controlled. Are you doing some sort of a temperature control up above, or you're just going to let it be how it is?
That's a good question. We could control it in certain areas because certain things don't need temperature control. You know, if you're storing tools and so forth, it doesn't matter if they get hot. But yeah, there's other things that might be more important. You know, it's designed also to accommodate appliances and actually functioning appliances. So we could even have things like refrigerators and freezers up in the ceiling. So you could have your beer you know, your cold beer, you ask for a cold beer on your Siri or Alexa, it knows where it is, and it brings it over to you wherever you're sitting in the space.
All right. So wait, now that part I didn't get. So it's stacked up above. So the robot comes over, pulls it down. Can the robot then move around the room with it?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, no, that's pretty cool. Okay. So
That's the real key. So we call it in-hand logistics, or, you know, in-hand delivery. Right,
but Ken, so I, you know, the thing that came to mind is this thing drops down like 4 feet from the ceiling, right? If I have an 8-foot ceiling, it's going to drop down to where it's 4 feet above the ceiling. And as I try to move this thing around, it's going to run into my chair if my chair is more than 4 feet high, right? So how do you control to make sure it knows what's in the room and can find its way through the room to bring it to me?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's all done with software, right? You know, basically collision avoidance software. So we have cameras and sensors that sense where things are in the room so we won't crash anything. We can actually lower all the way to the floor. So if you have a stack that's 4 feet tall and you want to access something that's in the top tray, we can lower that all the stack, the 4-foot stack, all the way to the floor, and you can then just grab what's on the top at 4 feet.
Okay, that's pretty interesting. Now, I have high ceilings in my house. I mean, I think they're, you know, 10 foot or something, or maybe higher than that. So, but on the other hand, if you do it on the first floor, then you'll need 4 feet before the second floor. So nobody usually has that. So it's only going to be at the top floor of your house that's going to work, right?
It could be on the first floor. You just won't have as much storage because there's quite a bit of space between, you know, above the joists. So you have, we hang down about 8 inches from the ceiling, from your current sheetrock. And then we can use that, you know, 12 inches of joist that you have up above there to store stuff. So it doesn't have to be 4 feet. We can store, you know, only 1 foot of stuff.
There you go. All right. So is this, how much is this going to cost me now to put it into my living room and have things dropping down from the ceiling robotically?
Yeah, we're expecting the cells to cost about $150 installed each. So we're typically, because there's no intelligence in the cells because it's all actuated by the robot. The robot moves around. You know, there's only one elevator and one actuator, which is in the robot. All the rest is dumb. So a 100-cell system would be about $15,000. And then we're projecting that the robot to start with is going to be about $10,000. So it's about $25,000.
For 100 of these cells, that's 10 by 10. That's a lot of storage.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. Now, another interesting place for this is in garages.
Right. Right?
I really think a garage is a more interesting place to do this because, you know, frankly, you know, I have a garage and it has a big roof on top of it. And normally the cars are under it, but, you know, I don't have enough room to have a shop in there. But if I pull a car out, I have enough room to have a shop, but I don't have enough stuff. But if I have it up above, it's plenty of space. It drops down. And now I can drop down tools or maybe more sophisticated things. How heavy are we likely to be able to have things that we handle?
We're designing to 200 pounds per cell. Now, obviously, you can't have, you know, the whole ceiling. If you have a large span, you know, with your current joist, you won't be able to have the whole thing covered with 200 pounds. So we'll have to put the heavier stuff near the sidewall, you know, near the walls. But we weigh everything that we pick up, we weigh. So we know exactly how much that you're carrying around and storing.
Okay, so if I put something heavy in, it's going to say, wait a minute, no, can't do it, but I can do it over here. Is that okay with you? And it's okay. And you'll pull it out. It'll go back up. It'll go bring a place where you can put it and you can put it there. Does it keep an inventory? Can I rig it so it has the inventory of what's where so I can find my drill or my hammers or whatever I'm looking for?
Well, ideally, we plan to have this voice activated. So you're going to use your Siri or your Alexa and you're going to ask for what you want. Say, I need a crescent wrench or I need a number one Phillips driver.
How is it going to know where that is?
So when you load it into the trays, you'll take a picture of it. You'll take a picture of the tray that has a barcode and a picture of what you put in it. And then the system will basically through AI will recognize what you put in there and it'll know where it is.
All right. Instead of me taking a picture, can't the elevator mechanism take the picture for me?
Sure. That's another way to do it.
Since it's not on the market yet, right?
No. So this is all in development. So these are the things we're going to continue to improve on.
So, So do I get like a royalty now on every picture that's taken by the elevator?
Sure, Fred. We'll give you a thousandth of a cent.
A thousandth of a cent each. Well, you're planning to sell a million of these things, and they're each going to have, oh my God, this could be worth a couple hundred thousand to me per year just based on your current sales projections.
Cool. There you go.
Okay. It's a deal. All right. So look, you can go to thecybershow.co and click on the button, and you can go to Cutthroat Robotics, or is it Stackable?
No, it's going to be Stackable. We haven't incorporated yet. That's why everything is kind of still listed under my my personal consulting website.
So you can just go there, click on it, and find out all about it and talk to Ken. And also we'll have your G-Wiz up there. So people are interested in investing in this. This is at the stage in time where you can invest at a really good price compared to what's going to happen, you know, 2 or 3 years from now, when it's, you know, got worth hundreds of millions of dollars and you couldn't get in it, you know, without selling your house.
There you go.
Matlack on the 0-1. Bobby hits a drive into the gap in the left center field. There she is. Full of double. Papers flying, everybody standing.
For more details on this pitch and to view their G-Wiz, go to thecybershow.co and click on their listing.
That was absolutely amazing.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. An insider at Coca-Cola was arrested for trade secret theft and espionage from the Chinese government. She apparently took the secret of how to coat the inside of cans, but got caught by the FBI before she could leak it out. Chinese cans will continue to leak because they couldn't leak the secrets needed to stop leaking.
Tuesday, June 6th at 9 a.m. Join the Angel to exit free monthly advisory call. Later that day, at 11 a.m., join the All.net monthly advisory call. For more details or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
We're discussing the history of the cyber world with Bill Murray. This is not the Bill Murray, the actor. This is William H. Murray, the well-known, globally respected cybersecurity person who has been working in this field for many, many years.
Long ago, the CISSP was created by you and a group of other people. In fact, I was invited to be in at the time. I think I needed to spend like $100 for the membership, and I didn't have $100. But I'm serious. I didn't. You know, as a really poor graduate student. But, you know, the fundamental concept that you brought forth here was this idea that people have to have a baseline of knowledge. And as I like to say, they need to know what the words mean. Can you talk to us about the whole CISSP and how that got created and what was behind that and your role in that?
Well, it started, I guess the whole thing goes back to when our numbers had reached the low hundreds. We all knew one another, and we also knew that we were not getting the kind of recognition that we would like to have. So we were talking about, and I proposed at a cocktail party one night that we elect one another. We put it together in a fellowship, and we elect one another, and we credential one another. And one of my colleagues said, no, I follow the Groucho Marx rule, which is...
I wouldn't be a member of any society that would have me.
Right. So that idea failed. A few years more go by, and in the early 90s, we decided to do a professional organization. And we decided that we would do an examination to qualify people, that they would also have to have experience, and they would have to sign up to a set of ethical principles. The rules for the exam were that we were going to test for knowledge that we expected of our security colleagues, but did not expect of our management colleagues or our technology colleagues. And so...
Okay, so the idea was to differentiate. And then the CISM came along later, the Certified Information Security Manager, for what the security manager needed.
Right. And then we've got one now for developers. We've even got some minor programs for operators, which would have helped in the NOTAM situation.
Do you have one for educators that tells them what they have to educate people on?
No, but there is the Colloquium for Information System Security Education, whose members are drawn mostly now from what the government calls the Centers of Academic Excellence for Security. We had two or three of those when we started out. Now almost every major university that teaches computer science also teaches computer security, and the centers of excellence have multiplied to the point that they can't all possibly be centers of excellence.
Yeah, they're centers of something.
Right.
Yeah, and, we have all these centers, but you know, it's really a distributed problem.
When we started, we had about 1,000 people who qualified to sit for the exam. We have since certified well over 100,000 people, and it is the single most sought-after credential in information technology.
It is. Now, I just want to put the numbers to a test here, because about 120,000 was the last number I looked up to see how many current CISSPs there are. But the problem is the asserted demand for people with cybersecurity expertise is currently, you know, something like 10 times that. In the U.S., right, that's a global number of certified right. people, but the U.S., which is, you know, a tenth of the world's need or less. So really, we need 10 million of these people, and we have 100,000. And so scaling that is one of the things that I've been trying to do for some years, but it's really hard to get people to even take, you know, the simplest course on this. I mean, the trust architecture course that I just, you know, built in the last however many months, you know, had its first sign up today, right? So
we have a lot of people who are qualified at the professional level, but we expect credentials at entry that we can't get. I remember when computers first came on the scene, there weren't any computer programmers. I was one of the earliest computer programmers. There weren't very many of us in those days. And the question was, how are we going to get them? So every time we sold a computer, we tested all the people in the organization to see who was qualified intellectually to be a computer programmer. And we trained them internally. We're not doing that in security. We're looking for experienced people instead of giving people experience.
Right. So what is the path forward? How do you fix that?
Well, what I would like to see is that instead of going outside the enterprise every time we have a security position to fill, that we look within the enterprise and try to fill it from within. Then we won't find people who have all the qualifications that we want. So we're going to have to train them internally.
Training them internally. So the problem here is seed corn, right? We don't have enough seed corn to produce the corn we need. So we don't have enough expertise to train enough more experts. And the people that have the expertise are all consumed in the jobs executing on the expertise instead of training.
Spofford says he is eating his seed corn. That is, he can't build his faculty because as soon as he gives somebody a PhD, they go out to work for enterprise or even a master's yeah. degree. So he can't build his faculty as much as he would like to. Now, I spent 7 years teaching at the Naval Postgraduate School. My students were officers. They were from all around the world. They were pursuing master's degrees. And I have to say, I was terribly disappointed. I thought graduate students would be challenging me, and they demanded that I challenge them. I even offered to do pass-fail. Absolutely not. These young warriors, it turns out, are highly competitive, and they want to see how they rank next to one another. One of the things I would like to see in education right now is that, you know, I had to write a paper while I was at NPS about cheating. It seems that people in programming were reusing code.
Oh, my God, what a horrible thing to, oh, wait, not make the same mistakes the last people made. Oh, wait, right. It's a good idea.
So people are reusing code, and faculty looked upon that as cheating. you can imagine how they're going to look upon papers that are generated by AI. And I
right.
say,
so this is the chat GPT thing. And what I've been saying to everybody is, and I bet you're saying the same thing. So that's why I'm going to say it first, because otherwise, you know, you'll be first. It's a tool, right? They didn't allow me to use calculators when I was, you know, doing my electrical engineering course. And most of my mistakes were addition mistakes because I flipped bits, you know, but the calculator wouldn't. You know, you need to learn to use the tools you're going to use in your career and not limit your students to not being able to use what's available. And if you can't devise a test that ChatGPT will fail and a decent student will pass, you should not be a professor.
Well, and the other thing is that if you look at all the demonstrations that are coming out right now about the use of ChatGPT, the creativity is all in the questioning. The creativity is in the assignment of the task. It's knowing how to use the tool, but there will always be a role for the person who formulates the question. And
right.
And
so they talked about automating the writing of a tax, right? And so they have somebody that spends 4 or 5 or 6 hours finally getting it to automate some attack that they probably could have written by themselves in an hour and a half, right? And by the way, it doesn't quite work right in all the circumstances.
Right.
I mean, I think we would be greatly benefited if all attackers only use ChatGPT to write their code. I'd be good with that.
I could live with that, yeah.
So okay. It's a tool.
It's a tool.
Right? It's a tool.
It's a screwdriver. Oh, my God. You're unable to do it with wood on wood. You're going to use a piece of metal, a screwdriver. What kind of a person are you? You can't do that.
Yeah, I got to say, I haven't met Bill. I don't know Bill. I love Bill, right? You know, because the get off my lawn, kids these days approach to things makes me nuts. It is so cliche. Everybody, as we age, we get nostalgic and everything else, and we start looking around, the world has changed. We don't like it. You know, I've always taken the approach that, you know, things are the way they are. You know, my job, should I choose to accept it, is to figure it out, right? And, you know, so much. I love that segment with Bill. You know, the kids these days are doing things again because they're probably right for some given definition of right, right? And ChatGPT, AI is coming along. My kids, you know, all 20-something now, you know, all during the days, remember the 90s, the PSAs on TV, you know, parents, if you're going to be irresponsible enough to allow internet into your home, make sure there's at least 7, you know, adults sober over 35 years old in the room, brightly lit whenever a child is near a computer. And I'm busily running Ethernet into my 2-year-old's, you know, bedroom because, you know, they're going to live in the world where there's the internet, right? And it's going to be the tools they have to use, right? And it turns out, you know, we're still here and the world keeps, you know, chugging along. So that wasn't the end of the world, and this won't be either.
Yeah, I mean, so the thing about Bill, you know, he talks about so many things. It's astonishing to me. I don't talk to him very often. I probably haven't talked to him in 15 years. But it's like continuing the conversation from yesterday. You know, it's like, and if you look at the length and the depth of his expertise, he's wonderful at presenting this stuff in a very direct and simple way. And his summaries of the situation are, you know, after years of in-depth contemplation from many different positions, I've come to the conclusion that convenience almost always wins out over security. And that's all you have to say. It's just so obvious that that's true, right?
Yep. And if you want to accept that truth and also be a security person, then all right, you're in. If not,
you're in the wrong boat.
You're in the wrong boat. I'll make people better. It's like, yeah, you'll make, and people
yeah,
will be
I don't
people.
Think so, yeah. The other thing there is, you know, the founding of the CISSP. So he created the most popular certification in the world for anybody in information technology. And a lot of people have complained about it over time, myself included. But the one thing that I continue to conclude is that people with CISSPs understand most of the words I use, and most people without them do not.
Right.
There is a body of knowledge that includes a variety of terms and terminologies that you should know about. And the lack of knowledge of what it means makes it impossible to have the conversation.
You know, in 15 years ago in Raleigh, North Carolina. A colleague, a good friend, Robert Martin, didn't know anything about security, but is extremely diligent. And he went and got his CISSP and ended up with this three-ring binder of the most immaculate notes, right? You know, and do a couple of things that Bill said, you know, at that point, you know, and you got some experience along the way, you know, because it takes some time to do that. Bill mentioned SPAP, Eugene Spafford, right? And on Facebook, in the last year, maybe six months ago, I think it was SPAF that started, you know, a bunch of us were discussing the CISSP and the value thereof. A lot of good commentary there, right? And then that's out of the sort of thing. It still has value. You know, it's good, you know, have a structure, you know, teach something, right? You know, and yeah, I think my input into that conversation was, look, you know, and I didn't know, you know, all this history. I didn't know the Bill. But yeah, somebody back then said, we need to do something. Took them a couple of years. They got it done. And you can critique it now, but all right, you go back. Don't tell me how it could have been done perfectly. Tell me how you would have sat in those shoes and those seats in those room with five people and tried to get agreement to get something on paper and something done and make some difference.
Right? That's the other thing. These small groups of people that end up changing the world, and it takes forever.
Yeah.
It is astonishing when you look at the large scale effects on society, the extent to which small groups create things that then expand. And the other side of it is, you know, you talk about viral spread of ideas. You know, there's a marketplace of ideas, and it has to be the right time and so forth, the right conditions. But there's a fertile field, and it can be used for good or ill, unfortunately. But I just love to talk to people who have toiled for a long time and done that job that changes the world in a positive way. And it's wonderful to see, you know, Peter has been on the show and so forth. It's wonderful to see them looking back at it 60 or 70 years later and saying, you know, this worked and that didn't.
Yep.
It's like, and you know, I look back, some things I did worked, a lot of them didn't, but here we are. And hopefully, you know, another 20 or 30 years from now, my troubles will all be over.
Yeah. Right. Well, and, you know, it's the school of hard knocks. I honestly had to think about it because, yeah, I've had all sorts of things not work. But every time I looked at it and said, all right, that didn't work out the way I thought it would. However, I'm standing here now. And from here, I can do things that I couldn't have done before. So now I get to go there. Right. So was that a success or a failure? I don't know. It's like kind of hard to tell. Right? Now I know that doesn't work. Don't do that.
Yeah, well, thanks. Well, it might work now. That's the other thing. So, right. You know, my timing seems to be off, right? I went open source at the point where it wasn't viewed in the same way. And so I went back to closed source, and then open source was successful. And then I went to open source, and now they're going, you know, it's one of those things where if you get the timing right and everything else right, and it's not that it requires vision as much as observation and communication and interaction with a group. It took me a long time to develop my understanding and skills to be cooperative with other people and coordinate activities, you know, getting more successful by doing that. But it's one of those things that some people are taught by their parents when they're, you know, 2 years old, and other people learn it when they're, you know, in their 80s. So, yeah. So it goes.
How do we know we're being successful at the Cyber Show? Well, here are the five ways we know today. One, we know the bad guys are listening because we get updated versions of our spam emails addressing the problems we found on the previous versions. Two, we know the broader listening audience is paying attention because they've complained about our use of terminology that should not appear on broadcast radio. Three, we know the startups are listening because we get contacts from startups looking for assistance in funding and growth. Four, we know the cybersecurity crowd is listening because they contact us on LinkedIn using email and other forms to tell us what they really think about what we say. And five, we know the elites are listening because they say, Dr. Fred Cohen, we're listening. If you want to tell us what you think, you can email us by going to thecybershow.co. If you have questions, email those questions and we'd be happy to provide on-air answers. The Cyber Show. Only on KMBY 1240 AM. We're listening.
Brought to you by Angel to Exit. We help grow companies.
The cyber world touches deeply on and closely aligns with progress in the intelligence and counterintelligence fields.
Nowhere is that more clear than in the discussions with John Tippett, who helps to put the cyber world in the context of national security.
That wasn't the reason I left Hughes. The reason I left Hughes was because I was becoming so involved in all this other stuff, all of it important, and getting out of my chosen profession, which was defensive security. And of course, I had a fairly decent background in offensive security. So I wanted to continue my practice in that area. So I left Hughes and went to work for Lockheed Missiles and Space.
So you go from the Hughes Aircraft Company, which is what one of my friends used to call, who used to work there, into Lockheed Martin, space and satellites, I guess, right?
So what and missiles?
Okay. So what was your role there?
I started out as a senior analyst, security analyst. I became manager of what was emerging as what we call today special access programs. I had several special access programs that I managed. I had probably 50, 60 security representatives that worked for me and had classification management people that worked for me and technical security people that worked for me. And it was during the beginning of that phase of my career that cyber and computer security emerged in the security world, not only as something that programs used, but something that we were growing in use of. When I first went to Lockheed, I didn't have a computer on my desk. And most of our security staff did not have computers. We had a secretary who had a typewriter, but we didn't. So,
and there were big computers and data centers, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, we had huge data centers. I remember several conversations with our director of security at that time as to who was responsible for the information in those systems and in those databases. And he would ask me, he said, "Well, John, that's the wrong question." He said, "The question is, who's responsible for computer security?" And I said, "Both those guys ought to have the same initials."
So were their initials JT?
Which they didn't at that time. We were like a lot of major defense contractors in Ronald Reagan's era, right? We were doing stuff that was considered so important to the national security that they literally would agree to almost anything as long as you could meet your deliverable in functionality that was supposed to be there. I acquired a nickname during that time, both from the Air Force, the Navy, not so much the Army. We didn't do things that the Army did much of. But the nickname that OSI gave me, that's Air Force Special Investigations, Office of Special Investigations, OSI said, "Okay, your name now, John, is John Waver Tippett."
Because you had waivers for, you name it, some way around it, you found it.
Yeah, and one of the cutest stories I tell, because it was classified for a lot of years, but when we were building the Sea Shadow, which was the first demonstrator for applying stealth technology to a surface ship.
All right, now, John, we got to spend a whole section on this one, because before you get into the details of that story, my recollection is that was a ship that was built in the desert. Is that right?
No. It was tested in the desert because it was too costly to test at sea. So
we tested a ship In the desert. Okay.
And so we cross the threshold.
So let's just start at the end. It's a little bit mind-blowing that you're going to be testing your ship in the desert.
Right. I couldn't even get myself to build it on land. Yes.
You know, wait a minute. How can you test a ship in the desert? Obviously, you're not testing how it floats, right? It's like because there's nothing to float on. And then this is a stealth ship, right?
Right. Now so, I want to know that story. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and we'll talk about that later. Before that, I want to walk through a couple of the other words that he used. One of them is offensive security.
And defensive security, right?
Right. He differentiated them. I mean, I know what defensive security is pretty much. You know, that's where people are trying to do things to you and you stop them, right? What's the offensive?
Well, you know, the old line, you know, if you have to fight off people in the doorway of your own home, it's too late, right? You know, so sometimes that means pushing, creating a boundary out beyond, you know, which we do as groups, as businesses, as nations, you know, all the time.
Again, that's defensive. They're coming at you. What is offensive security? Is that you going at them or
yes.
What is that exactly?
Well, right, you know, and in our last segment, we're talking about influence operations, right? You know, this is in the global space right now. This is the big question. You know, is it offensive security if I convince your people, you know, that up is down and that they all need to vote for down? So they're actually thinking they're voting for up, but I've convinced them that up is down. And if I do that externally, just by talking, just by words, is that an attack? Is that offense?
So let's talk. The context is critical here, right? Because you talk about security, I talk about security. When he says security, I believe he means things like national security.
Right.
And in the national security arena, you know, the best defense is a good offense, is the old saying, I guess, from football. But obviously, offense, you know, a military and all of its ability to strike things, that's probably what he means by offensive security. A nuclear deterrence is offensive security, right?
Well, in deterrence, again, look at it at any level. You know, it's sort of interesting thinking about that out loud, right? In the cyberspace, it's a little more anonymous, right? You know, in all these historical spaces, like, why don't I get mugged more often? You know, having done world travel the way I do it, which is walking around at night and, you know, just looking at things. Partly because, you know, I may give the impression that it might not work. You know, that I'm a good-sized male walking along with a certain amount of confidence and so forth. And just there's a, you know, again, why did the U.S. not get attacked? You know, because people will believe that wouldn't work.
Why were we not attacked very often? Because they did believe, but increasingly you see that being destroyed by us.
Influence.
It's not just us alone, but yeah, it's a combination of things. But on the other hand, it was really never the case, right? We were always under various kinds of attack, and we're always attacking other countries. So nation states, by their nature, have an attack capability and a defense capability. And I guess it depends what neighborhood you live in. So I used to live in South Central L.A., and in South Central L.A., my block was, at the time I lived there, it's no longer anything close to the record, but we had the record for most shootings in a block in 6 months. That was 2 killings in one block in 6 months in my neighborhood. And so the protection posture there for me going through the neighborhood was a little bit different from the protection posture, you know, living here in Pebble Beach. It's not that it can't happen, right? So nation states are in different neighborhoods, right? If you're sitting in the middle of the desert in South America somewhere, up on, you know, a couple thousand feet up, you know, you probably don't need the same military as the United States, which is a global superpower, which is effectively trying to say, you know, Pax Americana.
Right. You know, and as businesses, you know, we operate within jurisdictions, within nation states and so forth. In part, you know, what we're doing, you know, the same as we do as individuals, we're outsourcing some of that. We're saying, all right, you know, I'm not going to build my own military because, you know, I will be part of a larger organization, a larger, you know, group that has one, right?
Well, and then there's the surrogates, right? So the whole idea that we're not going to fight a war with Russia, we're going to have the Ukraine fight a war with Russia, or before that, you know, it's always these two folks fighting it out over there, and they're destroying their land and their houses and their people, and we're sort of back here, you know, Vietnam was, you know, China and the United States, basically. And, you know, Vietnam was getting ground to nothingness in the middle. So I just think that the whole concept of security is different when you talk about offense and defense. And historically, I'm a defensive security guy, but increasingly, I think that offense is necessary, especially in the influence operation space, because there's so much influence operation effort coming at us. If we don't counter that influence, it's counterintelligence is countering the intelligence efforts to find out information about us, but counterinfluence is countering their influence operations to try to, control the hearts and minds. And if you don't do counterinfluence, the other side of it is that in the U.S. government, the whole notion of freedom sort of says we should not be trying to tell people what to think. And so the U.S. government has problems getting into that space within the U.S., but we don't have any problem doing it across the rest of the world.
Well, yeah, pros and cons of everything, right? And I always think in these conversations, how do we, because people listening are mostly, thinking about business, and it's the same thing, right? In business, we're outsourcing the offensive, but, it's still there, right? Just because you're not doing it yourself doesn't mean it's not a thing, right?
Right.
And the pros and cons of, the self-forming aspect of capital, right? The old Will Smith bar scene line, right? The what is democracy? What does capitalism, have to benefit structurally? Forget about morally and ethically, over centralized massive authoritarian systems. And innovation is an overused word, but nonetheless, that's it, right? A small organization motivated by profits and winning, helping their country win, for example, can come up with solutions rapidly. And lots of those can come up with different solutions that evolve Darwinistically, as opposed to, having a massive force, a massive, nation state all aligned and structured all in one direction, the mainframe versus the internet. So I think the U.S. is kind of losing this battle right now. However, I'm extremely hopeful about the long term, right? Because it takes a while to turn a ship without just one person at the rudder. But
so now there are two other phrases that he brought up that I thought were interesting. Special access programs. I don't know if you know what those are, but those are I've been in some programs that might have been special access programs, but they're special. But that one leads us into John Waver Tippett. So now when your nickname is Waver in that context, everybody in security, you have rules, right? And the way you're supposed to get around rules is not by breaking them. You're supposed to ask permission. And when you ask permission, then the person in authority gives you a waiver so you don't have to follow that rule. And apparently, when you talk about rule breakers, well, he wasn't a rule breaker. He was a waiver guy. As we hear more from John, we're going to hear more about some of the interesting things that you might have to waiver. My goodness, what a notorious name. This is the guy that's doing the stuff where whatever the rules were, we're going to say, don't exactly apply here.
Well, I'll just use that as another, proof of my belief in the well-structured, adaptive system, right? Because in a corrupt system, there is no waiver. It's just, that's the aid of general whoever they get to do whatever they want. In an adaptive system, there's lots of rules because you have to have them. However, there's some ability to say, you actually just doesn't apply. Act as an independent agent, we trust.
So I just want to give an example. When I was at Sandia National Laboratories, we had procurement cards. So you got a procurement card, basically a credit card, but it was belonged to Sandia National Labs. Now, I'm personally responsible for it if I spend something that's not in my budget, but nevertheless, I have a budget and I'm allowed to use it. So then in the briefing on procurement cards, they walk through the rules, right? One of the rules, for my level of procurement card was not more than $5,000 a month. You can never exceed your actual budget, the authorized allocated issued monies. And the other, so $5,000 a month, but a transaction was also limited to some amount. I'm in the briefing room and I'm bringing up a hypothetical. So my hypothetical was, and this was during the time when people were worried about the suitcase nuclear weapons from Afghanistan, I guess. And so I said, so let me just really be clear on this. So if I'm in Pakistan near the Afghani border and I want to buy a suitcase nuclear weapon from somebody in Pakistan and it's more than $5,000, suppose it's $10,000. I can't do that in a single transaction. And because of the list of things I can buy, weapons, you're not allowed to buy weapons with this money. But if, for example, I bought gold with this money, $5,000 right at the end of 1 month and $5,000 the next day at the beginning of the next month, and had $10,000 worth of gold, then if I wanted to go across the border and buy the nuclear weapon and bring it back, that would be okay under the procurement card rules. To which, you know, so the person up at the front of the room is, you know, sort of scratching their head, thinking about it, saying, I guess it doesn't violate the rule. Now, meanwhile, everybody else in the room is distancing themselves from me. So no waiver required for that one, right?
Right.
Now, in the alternative, so now, you know, in the cybersecurity arena, I think I've told you about these briefings that we did, you know, teaching people about the rules, right? Like, you know, for example, if you want to go see a porn site, take it off campus, go somewhere else, go to the library, you can do it there. So we had cyber cops coming in. You may recall from our discussions with Kevin, and they came in and they were doing investigations, and we had some infrastructure set up for this purpose. And as part of the process, they wanted to do child pornography investigations from our infrastructure, including all the cutouts that I had created over time. And so, you know, that was one of those things where I couldn't do it without permission, but I got a waiver. I got a waiver, so we were able to do child pornography investigations from the basement of a, you know, former nuclear facility with cutouts and everything else. So generally speaking, you know, in the government, you can get a waiver for essentially anything with presidential authority, with some exceptions, right? So one of the exceptions is you can't get a waiver for classified information for nuclear secrets without a different authority. And but we're going to see how that debate works out.
Breaking news on the Cyber Show. Tuesday, June 13th, go to Angel. Present your company, get on the Cyber Show, become famous, and make a fortune. Or not. For more details, or to sign up, use the links at thecybershow.co.
We're talking to Doug, who has spent a lifetime dealing with the issues of identity management and has consulted for many of the largest enterprises in the world in this arena.
There's the difference between the question they want or need the answer to.
Yes.
And the information that they're using to get at that answer. And
that what you would like
to do is replace that
Boolean
information.
Right.
Place the information with the answer.
Yep.
So that they can reliably say, I have the right answer. Doug is allowed to rent a car.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have to know who Doug is. It doesn't matter
who Doug is.
He's allowed,
yeah.
Here's the rate he gets. He can rent the car. I don't need to know who he is. And the same for everything else.
I can generate a unique token for my credit card, authorizing payment for renting that car without ever giving you my credit card number. You know what I mean? Those kinds of things. The company, Hertz, presents the token back to Visa, and Visa acknowledges it, but they never got my credit card number. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. Those are, I agree. Those are things that are feasible. And maybe that's the next generation of identity.
Right. But I think that's user defined or user managed more, much more so than it is today. It has to be. And, you know, like I've learned in my 60 plus years that the answer is never this far right or this far left. It's in the middle. There's a middle ground here where we maintain more of the information ourselves, not propagated out there, but we can't do away with propagation completely, but it's a risk management decision in terms of what is propagated.
See, I think that this reliability requirement is that the information should be all over the place,
mm-hmm.
but, and this goes back to the why question, the purpose for use should determine what is revealed.
Exactly. And so, I should control access.
So this is another interesting question of ownership,
mm-hmm.
right? So the notion, I think, is that you should own all of the data about you.
All right. I know where you're going with this. How about most of it?
No. Let's suppose you own it.
Yeah.
And all the rights of ownership.
Yeah.
If somebody wants that information, then they should pay you for it, and you should be able to determine the charge.
Especially if they resell it.
When you say resell it, when they resell it, they can sell it for whatever they want as long as you get paid what you're charging for that. So my rule is $1 per bit for every bit in any way related to me for every copy.
Yeah, exactly. That's a royalty scheme.
That includes backups, right?
That's a royalty scheme, right?
Yeah. Well, why not? Royalty for ownership of information is a scheme that's long existed, right?
Heck yeah. That could work.
Yeah. I mean, there's obviously some minor details to be worked out.
Well, we got to convince
the problem is a dollar per bit. Okay.
Yeah. So I realize a bit's a tiny little thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, you know, my name takes, you know, a bunch of bits, but on the other hand, if you compress it, if you use a compression algorithm for my name, you can get it. If you just use my social security number, it's fewer bits.
Right.
Right. You can fit that in maybe 16 or 32 bits, however many bits.
Right.
As opposed to the number of bits for my name.
Right.
So, yep. So, but now think about that. So now, because it's so expensive, you have an identifier. So look, the bank is holding my money.
Yes.
And you can say, I'm going to go to cryptocurrency instead, but I'm going to just tell you, without fiat currency and without the force and effect of a government behind it, you know what's going to happen to it is Amen. What's happening to it. Okay. Yeah. So we'll assume we're going to stay in some form of fiat currency and we're going to depend on government and governance.
Agreed.
To structure the legal process of assuring that the value I have is the value I retain.
No argument.
So now the multitude of copies of the content, being whatever and wherever they are, they don't move around. They're stored by a resilient enough network of things so that yes. the actual facts are there.
Yes.
But as a human being, I can go to one of the authorized locations and get the magic thing that I can hold in my hand.
Yeah.
Or that goes into my phone or whatever
yeah.
that allows me to generate
yeah.
whatever answer to whatever question they want to ask.
Correct.
They ask the question. They say, here is the information I need to make the decision. And they right. send that to me.
Yep.
I'm standing right in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
On my screen, it gives me a list of all the things that they mm-hmm. want to know.
Yep.
And I can say, I can default to say yes to a lot of them, but I can mm-hmm. say, oh, here's things they're asking that I'm not generally allowing people to have.
Right.
And I can say no to those things. And then they can say, well, in that case, we won't sell it to you. Or in that case, we need these things instead. And right. negotiate
yes.
to the point where yes. they get the answer to their question.
Right.
Right. But really, the answer to their question is not the list of things they need.
Absolutely.
It yes. never is.
No, not
it
at
is.
All.
It is, can I get paid?
Exactly. It's always that. Can I trust that I will be paid? Trust that I will be paid.
Well, yeah. it's not always that.
Mm-hmm.
Can I trust that this person has an adequate education for the job they're applying to?
Yes, sir. Yes.
You know, yep. do they have the right credentials?
Mm-hmm.
Are they authorized for the activity?
Right.
Whatever that set of things is, that should come to you on your device. Yep. The device should verify you by your iPrint or whatever set of mm-hmm. metrics are appropriate to yes. the consequence levels of a false positive.
Yep.
The device should give them the answer yes or no.
Right.
In a manner that's trusted so they can say, go ahead. They don't have yep. to know who you are. Absolutely. They don't know anything about you. Go ahead. Right. Now, we have surveillance all over the place.
Yep.
We've got cameras everywhere.
Yeah.
So the camera's going to have your image.
Yeah.
And I'm, you know, if I have a camera, I can associate your image.
Right, for non-repudiation.
Well, but the image is there.
Yeah.
So now we're going to have to eliminate things like online searches for images.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I can back associate it all and do so automatically and quickly.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Yep. Now you're asking me to solve everything, and I can't. I haven't gotten that far yet, but I'm working on it.
I'm just getting you started. Okay. Well, there you go, Chris. What do you think of that final view of how the world could change?
You know, you and I have discussed this for many years, right? I agree. I think not only should every individual own their own information, you know, and be in control of it and be able to do whatever they like with it, but I think I could see structures that support that. And as we talked about in the last Doug episode, you know, I think ethical and transparent and clear, you know, again, leave ethics aside, transparent systems are more profitable. They're faster, easier, simpler. And if you're following guidelines, ethical or otherwise, they reduce overhead. And this sort of control could be in place, right? We're living through this era right now where, for example, social media companies monetize information about us that we're all giving away semi-voluntarily or unknowingly and so forth and getting reasonable benefits from it. You know, I don't want ads for things. If I had to see ads, I'd rather have ads for things that I care about. But, you know, we don't have any defined way to know. You know, maybe I don't mind, you know, Facebook having that information, but I don't know what they're doing with it. And if I could just know, it would change my relationship with that. I think it would change everybody's relationship with their own information and with organizations that are using it.
So I want to talk about what's happening in this, you know, social media combined with generative AI. So one of the recent things I saw, now, I guess Microsoft now owns LinkedIn, and LinkedIn starts identifying people with asserted expertise. And based on their expertise, they start putting up questions, making it look like somebody else answered this question. But because you're an expert, we're going to compliment you. We're going to elicit you to tell us a correction of the answer. The answer they provided is done by the generative AI. So now they're asking people with expertise to correct the answers. And as they do that, of course, they're taking that information and making it so that their products are more saleable without rewarding the authorship, the intellect, the person who actually came up with the answer, or in many cases, even associating it with them.
Right.
So in effect, they're trying to take the intellectual prowess of the people with expertise and turn it into the automated, you know, AI mechanism.
Yeah, I mean, this is where we get with again, the best of intentions and pathway to hell, right? You know, as, you know, taking just as an example, Microsoft is a public company that, you know, has fiduciary legal responsibilities to increase shareholder value so that people can trust investing their money, their retirement savings in there and not losing it all, or at least knowing the likelihood of losing it all. And if you're a person at Microsoft responsible for this sort of thing, and you say, okay, we can monetize this at very low cost and get this, you know, incredible, you know, economic benefit out of it, you kind of have to do it. If you don't do it, you're not, you know, investing shareholder public investors money correctly, and you're not doing your job. Now, is that ethical? No.
Well, no, hang on. I don't think it's necessarily unethical. Remember, you know, I'm using LinkedIn for free. I'm not paying them for access to their global social business network. So the price I pay, what they're charging me, is to be able to use the information I provide there.
Well, but this is the whole, you know, the whole supply chain and digital bill of materials thing over the last 4 years has made for me the words explicit and implicit just fundamental, right? I guess more than they ever were, right? Because we're implicitly having that relationship with LinkedIn. I'm very, very happy. I've thrown away literal garbage bags of business cards that were fascinating people, but I know that they've changed jobs and they're not useful. It solves that problem for me. We have this implicit relationship where we're implicitly allowing, and we may or may not. And this is, you know, my last comment on this. I think a lot of people will choose to explicitly accept those sort of terms, but they're not happy doing it implicitly. It's not transparent. It's not clear. And it doesn't feel right.
Right. If they were open and said it and explained the value, that would be different. But because they're trying to conceal it, that yep. makes it nefarious.
Right.
But the other thing is, you know, most people will do things for attribution. I mean, I'm happy to help people have a better set of answers to cybersecurity than the gobbledygook that gets generated by this AI. But the truth is, I have, you know, free books on my website. You go to my website, you can read whole books on the same subject that they're asking about. I write articles every month. What I don't understand is why they won't go and read those articles, attribute those to the fact that they believe, or, you know, they're claiming at least that they believe that I have expertise, and then weight those heavier than people that don't have that expertise.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's because we don't have the transparency yet.
And I think across the board, when you talk about transparency, we're also talking about surveillance and automated analysis of surveillance and other systems and methods associated with that. So are we, you know, this is the trade-off between knowing everything that happens everywhere and being able to track it and analyze it and use it however we want to. And privacy.
But again, this is what I mean by ethics and transparency. If the rules of the policies are ethical, or at least arguably ethical, again, if they're flawed, you know, you can see the flaw, we can debate that and fix it. Then we can see, in this LinkedIn example, right? You know, if I can see how my information is being used, I'd feel one way about it. Not being able to see, the simple fact that you can't see, we have no idea inside LinkedIn if whoever did this particular thing was trying to hide it, or trying not to advertise it, or maybe, you know, where they were in the organization had no ability to advertise it anyways, you know, but we can't see.
Or maybe they just assumed that everybody understood it.
Right. It's the lack of transparency leads to distrust, and distrust leads to, that's how you get in, right?
So if you can make it so that as somebody selling you something, I can assure that, you know, you're not going to misuse, or, you know, I'm not going to get in trouble for what you did, and I don't have to know anything about you, then that's great. I'm not sure that works for some things.
Well, the word appropriate comes up an awful lot.
Next week on The Cyber Show, Bill cleans up after the elephant in the room. John's shadows cannot be seen, but it's not because he's a vampire. Dave talks passwordless with scores of newbies.
Tom gets tenure but can't hold a job. Or rather, no job can hold him. More pitches, more frauds, and more. Only on The Cyber Show. See you next week.
A good time and bow. A good time and bow. A string-beating man and a fiddler for a band. A good time and bow.
The Cyber Show was brought to you by Management Analytics, trusted advisors since 1977.